2000 years ago, when people said don't mix milk and meat. Milk was not a pasteurized, it was a highly perishable product that started spoiling 30 minutes after you got it out of the cow. You had no refrigeration, your fish is rotting every minute. And so they make rules that say that, guys, just don't mix these things because then you don't know how bad it's going to be. Powdered, you know, beef is being fed to cows. It is also now known that the reason for the mad cow disease is basically species eating themselves.
Wow.
So when people say you drink this juice, it will detox you, that's complete bullshit. If anything, it's going to stress your system. Remember that random raw plant products are a huge stress on the liver. Our grandmothers didn't have temperature sensors and thermometers. The mustard is small and tiny. It has a tiny amount of moisture inside. Adding it to the oil, when it bursts, at this rate, I know the oil is just right hot enough. And if it's bursting at a furious rate, then I know oil is too hot. And if it does not burst, I know the oil is not hot enough.
Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome to another episode of Dostcast. My name is Vinamra Kasana. If you're listening to this podcast on an audio platform, make sure you give us 5 stars and click follow. If you're watching on YouTube, press subscribe because we release new episodes every Tuesday and Friday at 12 PM Indian Standard Time. Today's guest is Krish Ashok of Masala Lab fame on Instagram, Masala Lab on LinkedIn, Masala Lab on Twitter and many other spaces and places. Krish has come into nationwide mainstream appeal after his debunking videos around various food myths have been loved by many people across the country and also the world. Krish is a fantastic musician, someone who holds a job in the AI space, but is mostly known as the guy who helps you to tell kya aapki dal ke andar protein hai aur kya wo khane layak hai ya nahi hai, and many other cool things from a very scientific lens, which is sadly much needed in a space filled with quacks and pseudoscientists. This is a whirlwind of a long conversation that I think you will enjoy. We discussed everything from which kind of body types are best when it comes to absorbing high fatty milk products, how I did not know that we actually eat unfertilized eggs. I always thought we ate fertilized eggs, and the various complexities and nuances that make up the Indian diet but are mostly missed because people are using prescriptions over nuance. Anyway, that's all from my end. The episode with Krish Ashok begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is what I was saving for. Two things. Number one, I'm very happy to speak with the topper of Vidya Mandir Mylapore.
Not a topper. I was always ranked 2, but yes.
It's funny because in the room that I'm recording from, I had my friend, very good friend, Abhijit Ayur Mitra, come to the podcast, and we were discussing. I say, you know, you're always talking about geopolitics, and your defense opinions are much sought after. So why don't we do something else? Let's talk about your life, you know, growing up in India. And he mentioned of the many class pits that are off repute right now, he mentioned your name. I was like, that's so funny because I'm recording with him like literally after you.
Yes. So we used to sort of, we were part of a group that used to sort of hang out together when we were in school. And so he was the well-connected political kid who had like a Discman back in the day, which was sort of a very big
thing. Oh, really?
It was the first time I discovered Western classical music, actually, thanks to him. Otherwise, you know, in the mid-1980s or the late-1980s, Indians did not have access to Western classical music.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's definitely one of those people who's very, very, he knew what caviar is before anyone else did. At what point did you decide that I'm going to break food down and then start educating people in a scientific manner about the various intricacies of food, especially debunking it? At what point did you decide I have reached boiling point? Was it a consequence of you going on Instagram, getting infuriated with the number of quacks you saw there? Is it because a friend or a family member asked you, encouraged you, Krish, you have all this knowledge, why don't you speak about it?
It's a lot less deliberate than people make it out to be. Truth be told, it's sort of, you know, stumbling into it in some shape or form, right? For me, well, for starters, I think I've always been cooking food. You know, I lived in the US for about 7 years. So,
oh, what part?
In my early 20s in Texas, in San Antonio, Texas. Again, obviously, I had to learn to cook, and I had roommates, and they said, "You cook, you know, we'll clean the dishes." I said, "Okay, That's the cleaning is the harder part. So, and so therefore I was always interested in cooking, and I've always been cooking, right? I mean, that was always there, right? But I think if I have to step back, I think my way of learning things in general, all the way from school, at least particularly after sort of reasonably reaching high school, was sort of recognizing that, that if I had to play this game, I kind of recognized that memorization is not my thing, right? And you reach a point in sort of school where suddenly in like class 11 and 12, when you're kind of hitting these board exams and all of this, right? You pretty quickly realize that I think the kids who are memorizing better are doing better.
Of course.
They're playing the game. They sort of know that these are the questions that are going to be asked. And I don't care about understanding them. I'm going to nail down, just memorize this entire thing. It's not like many of the kids who I know wrote the exam in class 11 and 12 didn't really understand calculus, but they kind of knew that that question would come and they just like, just blindly, they just knew how to sort of crack it. But for me, somehow, I think I never, in a sense, maybe if I put more effort, maybe I could have memorized. But to be sure, I had a distaste for memorization. And so in a sense that for me, is it that the only way to crack this for me was to say that I'm going to understand everything from first principles.
Yeah.
So basically meaning that keep asking why till you get to, and in a sense, I think, and I was also fortunate to be surrounded by a couple of cousins and others who sort of had a very, very good understanding of science at a very basic level. And, you know, I had a cousin who did, was electrical engineer from IIT Madras. Weird guy who did all of that and then said, I hate the corporate world and I will go teach school kids physics, and he went on to become a teacher and so on, right? And he would often come home and say, right, what did they teach you in physics, right? And then he would say, we learned about electricity. And then they would say, oh, what did you learn about it? Static electricity. And so what did they say? You know, you rub a comb on your hair and then it'll attract
papers,
like pieces of paper and all of that. And so why does that happen? Is that because static electricity? Said, well, what is that, right? And we'll say, I would venture to say, oh, okay, because somewhere I think there is collection of electrons on these edges, so there's a negative charge, and the other side, therefore, by extension, there's more negative charge here, so there's a voltage difference. So, you know, it applies a force, and the force is very similar to gravity, because it's the same inverse square law by distance. So it's if you're close enough, I think it is attracting things and so on, right? And say, good. So then he says, why does charge collect on all these edges? Why doesn't it happen if it's not a core, right? And then I'm like, I don't know, right? So it sort of struck me that nobody asked this question to the teacher, right? And I'm pretty certain maybe the teacher wouldn't have known exactly why that happens.
Right.
So in a sense, I think, you know, the point was, to be honest, the answer to that question is also not easy. The answer to that question, you have to get into quantum physics. And it's not something you can understand. But it kind of, I internalize this idea that you can understand at various levels, right? But true understanding happens when you kind of are able to understand it at all levels as much as possible, while being able to communicate to someone at whatever level they understand. If you're going to insist on explaining everyone only at the quantum physics level, then you're being the expert on TV.
Right.
So in that sense, my defense mechanism was always that I'm not going to memorize the calculus formulae. I want to be able to derive why this is that way. So it was important for me to get a visual intuition of what calculus was, which essentially meant that is what is the rate of change, what is the area under the curve. And you really had to kind of really internalize what was Newton thinking about when he invented these things, right? You had to kind of get into that sort of frame of mind. So for me, it has always been exasperating teaching me because I would keep asking why and so on, right? But I kind of picked up enough foundational whys, if you will, to kind of get through engineering and do well and kind of get to that point. But I kind of always had that habit. So even when in my 20s, when I was learning to cook and so on, right? So I would go about and people, you know, I would gather recipes and so on. I understand, right? And then I would look for recipes and wonder, why should you add mustard after heating the oil, right? And none of the recipes told me. But then my grandmother told me that, you know, I think, you know, I asked my grandmother that this mustard, the eventual dish does not taste of mustard, right? So why are we adding mustard? Mustard does not seem to add any flavor at all, right? If you want a mustardy flavor, you need to soak a lot of mustard or use mustard oil. Adding few mustard seeds does not give you any flavor, right? Why are we doing it? He said, no, it's a way for you to know when the oil is hot. And I said, that is scientific knowledge. That's heuristic. That's a heuristic that we essentially, our grandmothers didn't have temperature sensors and thermometers, right?
Right.
And they're like, yeah, so I know, because I know the mustard is small and tiny, it has a tiny amount of moisture inside, adding it to the oil. When it bursts at this rate, I know the oil is just right hot enough. And if it's bursting at a furious rate, then I know oil is too hot. And if it does not burst, I know the oil is not hot enough, right? So essentially, it kind of felt to me that a lot of this practical knowledge that our grandmothers and mothers had, just because they were women, because they were in the kitchen, they may not have been educated, they may not have a degree and so on. We kind of assume that their knowledge, what they're doing in the kitchen, is somehow just a day-to-day thing, right? But truly speaking, it's chemical and materials engineering, right?
Yeah.
Practicals, not the theory, right? And so for me, I think my goal of saying that Masala Lab should be the ability to translate those women's knowledge in the language of science so that young people can understand and appreciate cooking better, right? Using first principles instead of saying, do it because I said so. Do it because Ayurveda said so, right? You know, that should not be the sort of mindset of how you understand this. So this first principles thinking is basically how I applied the same thing to food. During the pandemic, the other funny thing is that I always resisted writing a book. Right. Although I was a blogger, I was one of the early Chennai people who was into blogging, and you would have been in your like 7 or 8 years old when I started a blog and all of that, right? With the early days of, this was pre-social media. Blogs were the big thing, right?
Of course.
And because Bangalore and Chennai and Hyderabad were basically the first cities to get into IT, there was a bunch of people who had access to the internet and the tech skills to do blogging and all of that, set up our own websites. And so we started. I was writing, and publishers had said, you're writing well, so why don't you write a book and so on. I was like, boss, I am this new tech bro. Why would I go with a publishing industry that gives me 10%, 7% royalty, right? When I can build my own audience, I can build a larger audience than what a book can anyway reach, right? India doesn't have that much literacy. So why would I do? I was always that, the internet is much greater than all these physical old world models, was the arrogance that I had in that late 20s and so on, right? I'd built a social media audience. I was on Twitter. I was explaining science. I was doing music. I was doing all of these other multiple things. And then 2016, I kind of gotten disillusioned with social media in general. I did not think it was a force for good. It was already spreading polarization. I think, the US election, Trump had won and all of that. So there was a lot of things around the world. I said, I think, I don't think this is good. I'm probably just going to stick with Twitter because it has helped me in my life. But otherwise, I think that I'm going to deactivate, deleted my Facebook, deleted my Instagram, deleted everything, right? And then I was dialing down all my usage of social media. And then basically the pandemic happened. And at that time, I had found myself in free time. And I was cooking a lot more. I was thinking about cooking a lot more. I was on Twitter explaining food science a lot more. And then Penguin came back again and said, why don't you write a book? Right? And why don't you write it about cooking? Right? And all many of your things that you've written on your Twitter, I think they would make an excellent book. I said, okay, fine. I have some fair time. So I wrote the entire book in about 6 weeks. I had enough material already, right? Because again, the first principles mindset means that every recipe I've ever cooked on all my life, I have notes.
Yeah.
What did I do? How much water did I add to atta on that day? How much water did I add this time? When was it softer? When was it harder? So I had that sort of sense, right? This first principles way of thinking. So the book came out, and then Penguin said, we request you. I know you hate Instagram. Can you please create an Instagram handle? Because nobody clicks on anything. Nobody buys anything on Twitter. It's just a bunch of people posturing to each other. Instagram, you can truly influence people to buy your book. So why don't you create an Instagram handle? So I said, fine, I have a lot of research material. I illustrate. So I had a lot of drawings. I said, okay, let me share all of those illustrations, food science illustrations on Instagram. I created a Masala Lab, right? And not even with my name. I didn't even get the Masala Lab. It was some random restaurant. So it's an _ Masala Lab is the handle. And then weirdly enough, that is where exactly what you said happened. I suddenly found that people, instead of enjoying the beauty of science and the enjoy of understanding how their food works, were like, but why are you using nonstick? Why are you using aluminium? Why are you using microwave? And that entire world was like, why on earth are people afraid of things they have no business being afraid of? And it sort of struck me that somehow people, this is an entirely different universe where somehow the basic laws of science did not seem to apply. Right? Nobody thought in any kind of sensible scientific way about this at all. And in a way that can actually improve your mental health, and you don't have to be afraid of so many things. Right? And so therefore, at that point of time, exactly 1 year ago, somebody convinced me and said, you know what, you're doing all of these infographics, nobody cares about that, you need to make reels. I said, okay, actually, reels take me less time. It's just turn on camera, talk for 90 seconds, hit send, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the other stuff actually took me more time to make. I said, okay, less effort. I mean, I'm busy in my day job, let me do this. And then the first couple of reels kind of went viral, and since then I've never looked back, right? And then eventually that whole thing went from explaining food science to potentially debunking pseudoscience. To now where I get 500 DMs every day, people asking me, is this true? Is this true? Is this true? Right? And I'm right now literally exploring, can I create a GPT avatar of myself by training a large language model with all my content and helping address all of those questions, because I cannot honestly answer all of them. Right? There's no time.
Wow. So you've just been caught in this whirlwind and just taking it a day as it comes. And but what...
Absolutely.
You mentioned, I think I obviously don't have subscription to the Ken, so I couldn't watch the entire thing, but I was ignorant enough to read the headline. The headline said, the incentives of a food influencer are very different than someone who's essentially doing it for fun or a scientist. Yeah. You said that they're supposed to create content every single day. So in 90 seconds, you could potentially identify a single superfood or identify a potentially... you know, like a ingredient that has like dubious studies around it and completely either lampoon it or chaperone it as the next big thing, right? So when you started making videos, what did you notice like in just your research were the biggest myths people had around food and cooking?
Oh man, I mean, it's insane. And these myths actually, I look at these myths not as... I do not want to judge people who believe in myths. It's a very operating principle of mine, right? Because I think in that as much as I'm a person of science, I do not look down on superstition, right? It's very easy to look down on superstition. It's easy to look down on people who are superstitious. But evolution has wired our brain to hold on to these crutches in moments of crisis.
Of course.
And for some reason, I think... the reason why people are religious, people are faithful, people are superstitious, people hold on to these seeming abstract ideas and entities that are not grounded in factual reality or science, because it's part of their identity. And human beings value social identity more than anything else. So they are more afraid of loneliness than they are of anything else. Right? So in that sense, I think, you know, I do not want to look down on the people who are superstition. So when I look at superstition and when I look at pseudoscience, I want to understand why they believe what they believe and whether there is some basis to why they believed it at some point of time in the past, right? Where it might have made sense. So basically I look at these as multiple categories. So one category of this kind of misinformation and myths come from Ayurveda says something. So, and this is wrong.
Yeah.
So, and there the way to approach it is to say, no, Ayurveda is not incorrect. Because 2000 years ago, when people said, don't mix milk and meat or fish or some whatever it is, right? Whatever rules you have, right? Milk was not a pasteurized. It was a highly perishable product that started spoiling 30 minutes after you got it out of the cow. You had no refrigeration. Your fish is rotting every minute. And these are all things that could deeply cause you poisoning, right? Salmonella and these kinds of things. And people know this from observation. And so they make rules that say that, guys, just don't mix these things, because then you don't know how bad it's going to be. Consume the milk quickly, consume the fish in its own way, don't mix both and so on. You can sort of appreciate the fact that people may have made some of these rules at a time when there was no refrigeration, no pasteurization, no cold storage, and a bunch of these things, right? So, and then it is possible for you to then communicate to people and then say that, hey, you know what? It's been 2000 years. We've invented refrigeration. We've invented pasteurization. We live in a significantly more hygienic world where we can get rid of microbes at source, right? And so therefore you can, and also you can understand, explain the science that at temperatures like 2 Celsius, 3 Celsius or below freezing, microbes simply do not work, right? And so therefore in today's world, it's okay to mix. And then you can also say, look, Italians, the entire Mediterranean mixes milk and meat every day.
Okay? Yeah, 100%.
And they live 20 years longer than Indians. So clearly, again, it's to thread a needle and say, it's not like Ayurveda is wrong, but Knowledge needs to be upgraded every time a new thing happens, right? And the second point is that there are influencers using the name Ayurveda. Nobody's actually reading those original texts, right?
Yeah.
Some random person is saying potato, you must not do, etc., etc. Potato came to India in the 1880s or 90s. That is when it was cultivated.
It was not indigenous to us?
No, potato came from South America. Europeans did not have potatoes till Columbus and others went and discovered it. So potatoes are native to Peru, right? And they were brought to Europe in the 16th century. And then they were cultivated in large scale in India in the 1890s in Bengal. That's why actually Bengal, they put potato in everything.
So,
they were supposed to start using potatoes as a backup for rice in case the rice crop failed.
Let's just say my great-great-great-grandfather, if he wanted to have aloo ka paratha in the 1880s, he could not have it.
No.
That's insane. Wow.
he would have had other kinds of paratha. He would have had a gobi paratha either, because gobi is also of European origin. Carrot is of European origin. You know, funny thing, 80% of the vegetables we eat today are of European origin.
Yeah,
our diets have been changing constantly. Yeah.
I think you mentioned in one of your videos about how India is now trying to promote millets across the world. And then you mentioned how because of the opium trade that the Britishers had with China, millet and bajra and other indigenous grains were replaced with the place to make a space for opium. Are there other examples of British eradication of indigenous Indian foods and replacing it?
Oh, there are several. Right? I think so. So several in the sense that this is probably the most sort of egregious version, where it was just downright. I mean, it was just for no good reason, for no reason other than greed, right? I mean, this was an extreme example. But in other parts of India, many of the reasons are a little bit more pragmatic, in the sense that, think of it this way, right? So what they would do is that because they were ruling, they suddenly replaced the rajas, right?
Hmm.
And then suddenly people would have a famine.
Yeah.
Rice crop failed, something failed, millet, something failed, right? People would starve and people would say, boss, the Raja used to take care of us. Now, what are you doing?
Hmm.
And remember that these are not the Maharajas. No, these are guys who run, at least in UK, they run a democratic government. So, they're answerable to parliament and all that. No? So, they have to go about it in a very logical way. And their logic was to say that government cannot possibly support this many diversity of crops. Right? And so, what we'll do is we'll set up a Food Corporation of India. We'll set up a ration system. We'll set up a food security system. Where the government will buy from the farmers certain crops and store it properly so that it doesn't rot and all that. And then when there is a famine, and we will use that to give it to you.
Hmm.
So because, see, unlike the Rajas actually used to collect the rice directly as the tax. And then when you have a problem, they would give you the rice, right? The British were not collecting rice directly. They were collecting money, right? By that time, it had already been modernized, right? So they needed to create the food security infrastructure by themselves, right? And so like that, these policies all over India over the last 150 years, reduce the diversity of crops that farmers were incentivized to grow.
Right.
Right. So again, you think about it. The other factor that came in is that because science and technology kind of modern day industrial science and technology sort of originated in Europe, right? Everywhere. Science was everywhere. But the Industrial Revolution and that sort of massive growth of industrial research, etc., has kind of started in Europe, which meant that they were able to do biological hybridization and things on crops like potato, cauliflower, carrot, and those European vegetables in a way that your tindora and those things were not. Meaning that these native Indian crops probably used less water, did not require as many fertilizers, but their yield was not very high. So the farmers didn't make as much money. So the farmer growing tindora or some gourd or some native vegetable suddenly is incentivized to say, grow carrot. You'll make 10 times the money.
Hmm.
But of course, you have to use fertilizers. Of course, you have to use all of that, right? Therefore, of course, he's going to switch to carrot. So in the sense, I think the narrowing of our diets is basically a function of colonial policy and market incentives, if you will, over a long period, right? But of course, there are like these drastic examples, like the Bengal opium poppy one, like also the growth of semolina and rava as an ingredient in South India, right? Because South Indians don't eat wheat. They only eat rice.
Mm.
Right? And in the 1940s, the British were taking away all the rice to give for the war effort. Right? And so there was a rice shortage in South India. Normally what they would do, they would import the shortage. from Burma, and then the Japan invaded Burma, and during 1941, and so the British could not get rice out of Burma to bring it to South India. So their idea was, okay, let's convince South Indians to eat wheat. South Indians were like, boss, it takes us half an hour to cook if it's rice. It takes 3 hours to cook if I'm actually making chapatis. Nobody's making chapatis. Says, you know, forget it, right? So then they said, okay, we'll give you wheat that cooks like rice. So semolina, right? So you can cook it like rice. It cooks faster than rice, right? And they cut down the ration supply of rice during the war and told people in Chennai and Bangalore, no, we'll only give you rava now. Figure it out, right? And we'll teach you how to cook dishes. So upma was invented. Your rava idli, right? Idli requires rice. So rava idli is made from rava. All these were invented during the World War II, right? So they had these kinds of impact in some of these sort of events as well. But net, as I keep saying, nothing good came out of colonialism.
Except for maybe railways.
Remember, look, they built the railways. They prioritized and built the railways from places where there are minerals and things that they wanted to loot to bring them to the ports. If India had natively designed its railways, we would have built those main lines differently. We would not have built the lines where they are today. We still have inherited a bunch of infrastructure that's basically suboptimal traveling from. So it has taken a lot of time to get Indian railways to where it is today, right? And I know people say, oh, they gave you railways. Boss, if you would have eventually got it, and we would have actually prioritized population centers rather than getting from mine to, you know, port, which is what the British did.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's very hard to, especially in the Northeast, to actually travel by a train because there is no rail network whatsoever.
Yeah. No minerals. So no train.
I see. But on the other hand, Bihar and Jharkhand are very, very well trained.
Of course. Because that's where, yes. Yeah. Well trained, if you will. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, there's a bunch of things that I want to discuss. One graph that I found fascinating was about the spiciness of food. And this is from someone else that you had retweeted on your Twitter. People generally tend to believe that Indian food is spicy, correct?
Yes.
Then you made a distinction. You said that having too many spices and having the flavor of being spicy is drastically different. And in that graph, Ethiopia actually had the highest amount of spicy food. So I was wondering if you could help me understand, break down the word spicy itself and how it applies to our cuisine.
Yes. So, technically speaking, this confusion sort of comes from, I think, the common way in which we use language. But at the same time, I want to be respectful and say that just because food scientists use the term in a certain way, it doesn't override how the public uses it, right? So, meaning that if somebody tells me that food was very spicy, I'm not going to correct him and say, no. What you mean is that the food was very hot, not spicy, right? I'm not going to do that, okay? So, let me sort of explain this distinction here, right? So, as a food scientist, spicy food is basically food that is either, in technical terms, it means food that has a lot of spices. Now, so let me take a simple example. So, if you take a sambar in South India, right? It literally has coriander, red chilies, little bit of fenugreek, pepper, mustard. That's it. These are all the spices that go into a sambar. That's it. Okay? Mm. But you take a chana masala. Okay? You can count some 20 spices because the chana masala powder has a ton of spices from cinnamon to black cardamom to green cardamom to nutmeg to mace to a whole bunch of spices, amchur, so many things that kind of go in, right? So technically speaking, a chana masala has more spices than a sambar, right? But in common language, people would say a sambar is spicier than chana masala because Indians, when they use the term spicy, they are technically referring to the amount of chilies and nothing else.
Just or red pepper, chilies or green chilies?
To some degree. Both. Right? So basically, the reason for this is that, so let's, here's what's interesting, right? Salt, sweet, sour, bitter, umami. These are the only things you can taste. So again, let me blow your mind. You do not taste spices. Spices, taste is bitter. All spices taste bitter. All spices. Okay. The experience of the spice is aroma. So remember that what we consider taste or flavor is a combination of what happens on the taste bud, what happens in your nose, the texture of the food, the sound that it makes when you bite into it, and the color that it looks like. All of these together combined with your previous memories of how that food was, All of that is how you experience flavor.
Wow.
80% of this is smell. It is not your taste. It is not your taste buds or tongue at all. Your tongue can only distinguish between five things.
So if I were to close your my nose and eat something that is considered in common parlance spicy, I would not feel the spiciness of it?
You will not. Now, let me distinguish one more thing again. Chilies are special. They are not a taste. They are also not an aroma. They are a sensation. Now, what is the distinction? Taste buds detect taste. Sweet, salt, sour, bitter, aroma.
Hmm.
Then there are nerve endings in your mouth, as we have all over our body, the same nerve endings. They detect temperature, they detect damage, they detect pain, all these things, because for us to, you know, stay alive, right? The same things are inside. There's a molecule in chili that fools the temperature sensor in your mouth, which is there to detect what? Burning hot food. Okay. Like high temperature food, meaning food at 80 Celsius, 90 Celsius, so that you don't burn your insides. It's a protective device that we have, right? It's the same sensor that's there when you touch a hot thing and you take it off. It's because that same sensor, the TRPV1 sensor, is telling your nerve to just move your goddamn hand because it's something is hot. It's the same thing that's operating. Chili, the plant molecule, has over millions of years, insanely genius chemical creativity, has created a molecule that fools this sensor. So it fits into that sensor and your brain is like, oh my God, something, his mouth is on fire. It's not. It's a phantom sensation, right? And so it'll make you sweat. It'll send water to your face because it wants to cool you down, right? Your brain has no eyes, right? Remember, right? So it is sensing purely through the inputs and saying your mouth is on fire, right? So that is why when we use the terminology, we use the same word hot to describe the effect of chilies, because it is quite literally triggering the same hotness temperature sensor.
What would you call food that is that has a higher temperature than? Would we not call it hot? We often say, this food is piping hot.
Food is hot. It's piping hot. Right. And unfortunately, that's the problem with language, right? There's always these ambiguous terms we use. But we also use the term hot to describe the fact that it was actually pretty hot, right? To describe the heat of chilies. But Indians typically simply use the term spicy. Now, there is a little bit of a nuance. There are a few other spices, like particularly pepper and ginger, okay, which also have molecules that also trick the sensor, but not to the degree that green and red chilies do. So they also feel, that's why pepper, by the way, feels a little bit more on your throat.
Correct.
Ginger
correct.
Also, right? So those basically, they trigger a bunch of those, the same receptors, but less so in your mouth, but more so in your throat. That's why. So in fact, the funny thing is that your Vicks VapoRub and all these other cough relief things tend to have ginger, pepper extract because they irritate that nerve sensor. So if you have an actual inflammation in your throat, your brain has to deal with two problems. This something is burning here. I have another virus problem is there. What do I pay attention to? So the brain will reduce the attention on the cold and pay attention to that. So you suddenly feel relief.
Wow.
And the fact is that this is completely fake. After 10 minutes, your brain will realize, yeah, this is somebody crying wolf. There is actually no serious heat there at all. So I'm going to, that is why people who eat chilies a lot eventually can continue to eat chilies a lot.
Yeah, my dad is like that. He eats 5 green chilies every single meal.
Because his brain is like, boss, I know what you're doing. I am not going to raise the panic stations. Whereas my wife, you bite one chili, she needs to like literally go to the ICU level panic. That's what happens.
Yeah, no, even in aloo paratha sometimes, they'll have the odd green chili in it.
Yes.
And I'm not used to it. So I suddenly feel that sensation that you're describing.
Exactly. So the interesting thing, so as I said, food is three things. That food, so one, heat, the fake sensation of heat comes from chilies and to a smaller degree, pepper and ginger. And all the other spices give you aroma and we can detect 10,000 different aromas. And the weird trick that the brain plays is that when it sends the information to your brain, it makes it seem as if the sensation is coming from your mouth. Because of the weird way in which we evolved from fishes, our nose and our mouth share the same thing here. Okay. So we almost always will start choking if we feel food has gone through the breathing channel.
Correct.
But unfortunately, the smell apparatus is all entirely in the breathing channel, because originally smell originated as a way to prevent you from breathing in poisonous air.
Wow.
It never was a problem, because animals eat food that has like no serious aroma. It's only just raw meat and protein and things like that, right? Only humans, only in the last 10,000 years, have learned to cook food and add all these aromatic things and make aroma a very central thing about human cooking. It's a very new thing.
And probably created a traditional industry.
Yeah, correct. And we have largely just adapted to use our nose for that. That's all.
Wow.
And the best part is that, so therefore what happens is that when Indians use, so technically speaking, an Ethiopian dish will sometimes use 30, 40 spices. But they may not use chilies. They may not use as many chilies. Even within India, the south and the east are going to use more chilies. And the north and the west use less chilies. But the north and the west use more spices.
Insane how nuanced changes the game.
Yeah. And it's really weird, because where do all the spices grow? They grow in the south and the east. Right? So, entirely, basically, 90% of all of your spices, the expensive spices, all come from Tamil Nadu and Kerala. Nowhere else. Right? Pepper, nutmeg, mace, cardamom, all of these things grow only in the deep south. Nowhere else. Because you need like super tropical conditions.
Why is the north overly indexed on dairy? And there is a second part of this question. Yes. I live in the state of Haryana, in the city of Faridabad, which is Haryana's largest industrial city. It falls in the NCR region. And I've noticed that there is a fondness for all things dairy, right?
Yes.
And I'm not talking about Indian cuisine. Jo Indian cuisine restaurants that you typically go to, North Indian cuisine restaurants, those generally don't have too much dairy beyond the odd mango lassi or the odd lassi that they offer. But in households, paneer is the big one. Yeah, paneer.
Yeah.
But mostly what I found is that there's a very heavy over-indexing on all things dairy. And more specifically, around ghee and white butter, which is called makhani.
Absolutely.
Right. So, something else I've noticed is, because I grew up in a household that also made its own white butter and ghee, what we would do is, my grandmother and my mother to this day, add makhan or ghee to whatever dish we're having to accentuate the taste, right?
Absolutely.
So, I'm always used to having food that has ghee and makhan in it. Now, the times I don't have it, I feel strange. But it surprises me, because you mentioned that having ghee in too many quantities is not the healthiest thing. But all my life, I've just had it. Like, I've had mugs of makhan by myself.
Yes.
And my blood tests are all fine. So, what am I missing?
Yeah, exactly. So, this is an interesting thing, right? So, first and foremost, one of the things that people often don't understand, and only now in social media where, like, you know, 100 years ago, somebody living in the south would not have known of the existence of someone living in the north, right? There was no internet or TV or radio and so on. So it's all of a sudden, we suddenly are exposed to each other. Everybody is sharing their own thing. Everybody is sharing the way they cook their food. And because food is so central to your identity, you're regularly assaulted by other people doing things to food that you cannot accept.
Right.
Right? But they've grown up doing it. And this cuts across many ways, right? Whether, you know, you eat meat, you eat fish, you eat something else, people eat some fermented stuff, people use a certain kind of oil that you think is not good, or somebody eating insane amounts of butter and ghee and not having heart disease and so on. So we are constantly now discovering the fact that the world of food is insanely complicated, right? That's the first thing. The second thing is that our food choices, and we briefly discussed the impact, just what colonialism had. Now imagine over last 100,000 years or 20, you know, even let's say 20-30,000 years, impact that geography has. That is the first long-term impact of what people eat, what essentially they can grow in their neighborhood, in that part of the world.
Agreed.
And that entirely is down to geography. And that geography is down to how and where rivers flow, what your topography is, where you can grow what, and where you can do animal husbandry and where you cannot. And so on, whether you're close to the sea and so on. So basically, if you look at sort of like a map of India, you will find that the largest, flattest, most fertile part of India is basically the Indo-Gangetic Plain.
It is not.
Which is basically the Indus and the Ganga and the Yamuna and that entire stuff. And the other interesting thing about it, flat as a pancake. Completely flat as a pancake. Now, the moment you get to the Deccan Plateau and downwards, the landscape topography is just completely up and down, and you don't have large flat swaths of land at all. And so first thing that this does is that, one, the North Indian plains, you can grow three crops a year comfortably, right? Here's the point, right? Government in Punjab says, I will not give you power, I will not give you free whatever it is, unless they give you a window because there's a water shortage, right? I mean, groundwater shortage and so on. People are still able to grow three crops in a limited, not even half, in a half or, you know, shorter 8 or 9 month period itself, right? And then burn it so that, because, you know, that's why they burn it, because they need to quickly grow the next one, right? And that's what's causing the problem in Delhi and all of that. But the interesting thing is that it's incredibly fertile because there's so many rivers over millions of years has deposited so much fertile soil, okay? So one, therefore, you can grow grain crops and dal and things like that at massive scale. At a scale you cannot grow in the east and the south because you don't have that many flat plains. That's all. The second thing is, all human societies need a source of carbohydrates and need a source of protein. Okay. Now, if you are in the mountains, you really cannot do agriculture for half of the year. So almost always, first rule is mountains, you're going to be eating meat.
Yeah.
So even in the north, the moment you go up the hills, people will eat mutton, people will eat a lot more. You know, in fact, in Kashmiri pundits are also meat eating, right?
Correct.
So because, you know, you'll starve otherwise, or you'll be out of, you know, protein and so on. So, and if you're on the coast, the cheapest source of protein is the sea, because you can just, you know, pick it up from the sea. It's there for the taking, right? Fish and seafood is always there along the coast, right? Now, in this part of the world, now also consider that animal husbandry for the longest amount of time we've had to do because, you know, agriculture produces a lot of waste. You grow a rice plant or a wheat plant, you consume just the seed. Most of the rest of the plant that you ended up putting all the fertilizer, all that, and growing is all waste. You can't eat. Right? So human beings cannot digest cellulose. So tens of thousands of years ago, human beings figured out that let's create a circular economy. I'll domesticate a bunch of these animals that happen to be here. That animal will eat all my agricultural waste and turn that into protein for me. Right? And their dung is also fertilizer. So it's basically a completely sort of integrated system. Now that's basically version one of the story. Version two of the story is that one particular animal, they would have tried everything. In the Middle East, they tried goats, right? Somewhere else, I think in Central Asia, they tried cows and so on, right?
And they also tried
camels and a whole bunch of things, right? And particularly the people who did cows, which is, by the way, the Indo-Aryan people in that part of the world, they figured out that, hey, you know what? By the way, I get this if I can artificially select for a breed that is giving me, that's producing far more milk than it needs to give its baby. If I can artificially select, this happens much later, okay, right? Much after we originally domesticated cows. Right? Original domesticated cows would have given only not enough milk for you to take extra, only for the calf, right? But now the cow actually produces so much milk that you have to milk it. Otherwise, it'll go sick, okay? Right? Now, so they would have found out that, I have now have this breed, and I'm getting what is an insanely high quality, highly nutritious liquid, which is fat, which is protein, and every fat soluble vitamin and so on. If I get this, I can make one more optimization. I don't need to kill the animal. Right? Because I can use the males for agriculture, because at that point of time, I didn't have tractors.
Yeah.
So, hey, I can then castrate them so that they behave well and they don't like go wild and kill me. And then I will use them as labor for my carts and my agriculture. And the females, I will worship, I will take care. Because, by the way, this liquid allows me to not have to go through the expensive mess of killing the animal.
Right.
So it's an optimization. Now, remember, but the only place you can do this is in the north and west of India. So when people want to try and find out, why do South Indians eat beef? It's because we don't have the goddamn pastured land that North Indians have. Right? And so, and the other thing that happened is that as a result of hundreds of thousands of years of dairy consumption, the people who settled in North India were the same people who also, one part of it also settled in the Central Asia and also settled in Europe, by the way. This group of people have a genetic mutation that allows them to digest lactose as adults.
No wonder.
Your grandfather can drink one large cup of milk without having a problem. Okay. My grandfather will need to go to hospital if he does that.
Really? It's that bad?
Yes. It's not that. We all, as a South Indian, I grew up assuming that once you reach 40 or 50, you can't digest lactose. So you slowly cut down. That's why we are South Indians obsess over yogurt. Because yogurt cuts the lactose, right? So the bacteria eat the lactose. So now I can still get the benefits of milk without the lactose. Okay. Oh. So basically North Indians are the genetic freaks in that they are the only population of people on the planet alongside North Europeans who can digest lactose as adults.
Wow.
Whereas South and East Indians cannot. So by the way, you know, what is the per capita consumption of dairy in South and East India? It's 1/3 of what North Indians consume. So yeah. So you putting makhan on everything, ghee on everything, that's absolutely 10,000 years of that dairy culture that was made possible by that geography being in that part of the world. And the fact that you have so much pasture land that you can actually efficiently get animal protein from paneer and all these other things, and you don't need meat as much.
Wonderful. Whereas
the only way you can get animal protein, and trust me, the vegans are just idiots. You need amino acids from animals. You know why? Because we are animals.
Yeah.
There are 9 essential amino acids that you cannot get from plants in the amounts that you need. Unless you're an extraordinarily rich person who can afford to buy supplements and get multiple plant sources, mix and match and do all of this fakery to get a healthy vegan diet, which you can. If you're extraordinarily rich, you can be vegan and be healthy.
Yeah.
If you're a villager in India, you've got to be kidding me. You better go eat your egg or drink your milk or slaughter a goat and eat that. That is just, we are animals, we need animal protein, right? And so I think, you know, it is just that I think, you know, this is why, and the other point is that the other beautiful thing about milk is that it also has fat, which you can churn that fat, and therefore butter and ghee become your cooking mediums.
True.
In much the same way, what do you see when you go to land in Kerala? There are more coconut trees than human beings. Of course, they're going to use coconut oil as the thing. So you top your food with makhan to make it delicious. Keralites top it with extra virgin coconut oil.
So it's all right? A consequence and of Bengalis, the geography.
Yeah, Bengalis. Yeah, Bengalis top it with kachi ghani, whatever, mustard oil.
Yeah.
Right? And in my part of the world, in Chennai, it is extra virgin sesame oil. Because that's the... And if you go to Vidarbha, cottonseed oil. If you go to Andhra, groundnut oil. Andhra and Maharashtra is groundnut oil, right? So every part of India has a source of fat, and basically that's what defines, and a standard source of what they consider to be animal protein. If you're on the coast, it's seafood.
Yeah, no wonder why so many of my paternal side of the family and maternal also existed completely on a vegetarian diet. But the thing that most people miss is they were disproportionately consuming dairy at a level that is preposterous to everyone else. But I remember liters of milk.
See, yeah. Exactly. The term vegetarian is a very weird Indian term. Because for some reason, vegan is very clear. It's like nothing that comes from an animal is what vegan is. No honey, no milk, no dairy, no butter. Okay, that's what vegan is, right? No eggs and so on. Vegetarian is like it's whatever I say it is.
Yeah.
I choose to say dairy is acceptable because, by the way, because, you know, 500 million, 600 billion people in India who all live in the Indo-Gangetic Plains, that's what they eat. And so they've defined their diet as vegetarian.
Right.
So they've kept out eggs. Very weird, right? Mm. See, think about it, right? Meaning that, see, milk is a product that comes from a mammal that has to get pregnant.
Okay? Correct.
You have to forcibly keep that cow pregnant for 10 years back to back, right? Whether the cow wants to be pregnant or not. No.
Sorry, chance. Sorry. Help me understand this. I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes.
The cow is kept pregnant, so when it's ovulating, that's when we get the milk, or am I getting something
not
wrong?
Not ovulating. Postpartum, meaning that it has to give birth.
Okay.
So, it has to get pregnant, it has to give birth, and then for the next 9 months or so, some certain months or so, depending on the breed, it's going to produce milk. And it's going to produce so much. It's a breed that has been genetically, I know sometimes people get worried by the term genetically modified, but honestly speaking, that's what we have done over thousands of years.
Yeah.
We have artificially selected for breeds that give you more milk, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, we only force them to, you know, produce the next generation of cows and calves. And that's what we've done, right? And so the cow has to be non-consensually kept pregnant, back to back. So gives milk, gives birth, gives milk for a while. Then the milk runs out. What does the farmer do? Time for you to meet the bull again, get pregnant again. That's just basically it, right? So, you know, if you just put a human being in the position of the cow, that's some of the worst human rights violations you can do, right? So when you think about dairy, and I think vegetarians somehow very conveniently forget that this is what it takes to get you milk. And this is what vegans will keep reminding you that, by the way, this is what happens, right?
Yeah.
And here's the interesting thing. On the other hand, the hen, okay, basically like any female of any species will produce an egg every, at a frequency.
Yeah.
Homo sapiens produces once a month, once in 28 days. You know, that's what we call menstruation. So
yeah.
The difference between birds and mammals is that the birds package that thing inside a shell and all of that, right? Whereas humans do. That's the only thing, right? Because humans carry the live young. Whereas the actual chicken is not being pregnant inside the hen. It's being grown, going inside the egg. So basically in the originally the jungle fowl that Bengalis and Biharis domesticated 10,000 years ago, it's what his food historians believe, is a bird. We domesticated it because it wasn't good at flying away. So it's obviously easy to catch it, right? And then we found that it lays an egg. And we found that the egg is like goddamn delicious, right? And then we also found out that if you prevent the male from getting anywhere close to the female, it is still laying an egg at a certain frequency. By the way, it used to lay once a month. Okay. And then what did we do? We said, huh, by the way, this particular one bird I saw, it is laying twice a month. Let me pick that up and let me make sure that it has sex with a male and let's see if its offspring is also producing twice a month. And then like that, we do that over 10,000 years. Now you have a hen that produces 300 eggs a year.
That's insane.
It's basically having a period. It's having a period every day. Right? Now, the key thing to an egg is you never let it go anywhere close to a male. So cow milk is exact opposite. You got to keep it pregnant. Concept of an egg is you prevent the hen from having sex. So what you get is the unfertilized egg. There is no baby chicken inside that egg. It is
what?
And this is, I'm amazed that people do not realize this, that they are not taught this in school. There is no baby chicken in the egg you eat. The entire poultry industry exists to prevent a hen from having sex.
I feel like my entire life is a lie.
If it would be gross if you cooked an egg and found a baby chicken side and you don't.
So it's just an unfertilized embryo.
Yes, it's the hen's period. It's not an embryo. An embryo, remember, an embryo means that the male and female met and formed an embryo. This is the ovum.
It's like if
the hen is like, okay, I did not have sex today. Well, here you go. Here's the egg. It's a waste. I don't care about it. You take it. That's how poultry was born. Yes. I think so. Let's put this in perspective. Again, we cage these hens. Okay.
Okay.
And we make them lay. And yes, of course, there is all form of food production. There is cruelty involved. Again, but we also have a billion mouths to feed.
Yeah.
It's a different, so it's, I'm not saying it's completely moral or anything, but it's weird that Indians consider milk to be vegetarian, but egg to be not vegetarian. It's completely arbitrary. And you know why? It's because the cultural zeitgeist, the food cultural zeitgeist of India, the term vegetarian largely describes the eating habits of people in the Indo-Gangetic plain. Whatever you guys say, is vegetarian. And because you guys don't eat eggs historically, eggs are not vegetarian. There's no reason it should not be. In England, in UK, if you ask for vegetarian food, it will include eggs.
Yeah, I have noticed that in the breakfast menu specifically.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. But in India, it has to be red dot.
Wow, man. This is some groundbreaking stuff that is, I guess, like very obvious
really,
to you.
It's really funny in that it doesn't have to be groundbreaking. This is really basically, like, if as a kid, if you just maybe were taken to a farm.
I have been taken to several farms, but I've never seen a
chicken hatch. I think, you know, you would have spent time around the hens, etc. But I kind of noticed a pattern that somehow the egg-laying hens do not get anywhere close to a rooster. They will absolutely prevent, because the last thing you want is the uncertainty of not knowing whether that egg is fertilized or not.
But have there been cases where people have eaten eggs with like chicks inside them?
It is, in fact, there are cultures, even in India, there are videos on Instagram where there are people. I have seen in Haryana, I've seen it in UP as well, that there is it's a wrestling culture where eating the fertilized eggs is supposed to, there's a myth that it will give you more strength and all this sort of, you know, nonsensical beliefs are there. So, but it's a very minority thing. Most average people would be completely grossed out.
Wow.
If you eat a fertilized egg.
In the most disgusting way possible, if you were to ask a woman and say, can I have your period eggs, and you cook them, is exactly what we do to a hen.
Yeah, but so again, as I said, no, I think it's also a very masculine point of view to consider periods to be disgusting.
No, right? in the sense.
Right, in the sense that,
if you had a female partner, you would never say, hey, can I get this stuff that has come out from your uterine lining and cook it? It's you would not assume that.
In that sense, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But no, so again, as I said, from your own species, you want.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in the sense that a hen, a chicken is not going to eat its own egg, right?
Yeah.
Even if it is unfertile.
Although I've seen videos of chicken eating KFC when given the choice between grain and KFC. I have seen that.
Yes. Again, as I said, powdered, you know, beef has been fed to cows. And it often used to be in the US. And it is also now known that the reason for the mad cow disease is basically species eating themselves.
Wow. Right.
So, you know, why all species are, by the way, so one of nature's defense mechanisms that we've evolved is that there is a natural aversion and ways in which you prevent one species from eating itself, except in the harshest of circumstances, right? Why is cannibalism rare? It's rare because we have an inbuilt aversion to this. And also eating your own species introduces prions, which are basically things that are there in the nervous tissue. And them in your blood is a bad idea and causes, I think, a condition similar to the mad cow disease, right? Species eating itself is said to be one of the causes of symptoms similar to the mad cow disease. So that's why in general, species do not eat each other, except in the worst, I am starving kind of mode.
Have you heard of the popularity, this newfound popularity of breast milk in the US, where adults are now trying to, some fringe health freaks are trying to consume breast milk. And I was looking at a paper to see if it was actually true or not. And I found that it actually has more contaminants and less protein, but it's still popular. Is there any?
So the problem with all of these, it's a very bad idea to start with. Okay?
Yeah.
First and foremost, humans do not generally produce extra. We're not genetically modified like cows to produce extra. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had 20,000 years of animal husbandry, and we have a bunch of animals that we have around us that can give you all the milk you need. Okay, if that's what you want, please drink a goat's milk or a cow's milk, right? Why on earth would you do this? And the second thing is that I think, again, as I said, that entire thing is designed for a fetus. It's not designed for another, right? It just so turns out that, think about it, a cow's milk is actually designed for a calf. A calf is a relatively small thing, but actually compared to a human, it's actually a pretty large thing, right? So it's fat content and many other things. Kind of also fine. It also works for us. But human milk is actually designed for a fetus that's about this size. It has bacteria. It has a bunch of other things that are aimed to start the gut microbiome of the fetus, intestine, and so on. So there's actually, you know, the problem is that it's hard to tell you whether it's healthy or not, because we can't conduct enough experiments. It would be completely unethical to do so. That's the point.
There are several pictures of South Indian and North Indian thalis circulating on Twitter many health influencers seem to tout as perfectly balanced and healthy meals. And recently, a Shark Tank judge also did the same. Now, I'm not expecting them to have complete knowledge.
Yes.
But now I think it's universally known that the North Indian diet, let's just say the Indo-Gangetic diet, is severely lacking in protein if you discount dairy, right? Would you say that's an accurate assessment?
Actually, I would extend it to, I would actually say that the typical urban middle class and above diet in any part of India.
Even the south, even the east.
Even the south.
The northeast is an exception.
Even the east.
The northeast.
The northeast maybe is an exception.
Mm.
But most of the urban middle class and above diets on average, except the, maybe the rich who are privileged enough to say, I need an extra piece of fish and all that, right?
Yeah.
As an average, so it's, look at this. So the typical American meal has more protein than you need. Okay.
Yeah.
The typical Indian meal has less protein than you need. That is a problem. Okay. Now, to some degree, I think if the meal is a, let's take a typical lower middle class, what's called a fish thali on the coastal Tamil Nadu or all along the coast in Kerala, Karnataka, Maharashtra. Fish thali is basically rice, fish curry, fried fish. Okay. Now, that is actually not bad at all. Again, you do have to come and see how much rice people eat. Okay. This is a mountain of rice. Okay. So therein, the entire balance again is completely screwed up by the fact that people still consume an insane amount of carbs.
Yeah.
Because carbs are cheap, right? And so on. So therefore, I think there is a, it is complicated. I think, you know, many of the problem, there are 100,000 ways to construct a balanced meal. There is no one single way to do this. Right? But, you know, in a sense, it's actually possible for me to say, take a look at a North Indian thali, and a professional nutritionist would be able to say, you know what? Add a little bit more paneer, cut down on one paratha, and a little bit more dal, more vegetables, and so on. And that can be made into a relatively balanced meal, right? And again, I can look at a South Indian meal and say, even a South Indian vegetarian meal is even worse, okay? Because they wouldn't even have paneer. Okay? So basically, it's even more lacking in protein. There, I think unfortunately, the only protein they will eat is the yogurt. Okay? So let's say, nutritionists say, add a little bit more yogurt and so on. But please also consider adding. So for example, in my son's school, the school cooks the meal, and because it's a mixed kid, so, you know, it has to be vegetarian and so on. So they basically add soya chunks. So that's the only way to sort of get the kids the protein they need. And actually, soya is actually a very, very good, high quality plant source of protein. And people have all kinds of misconceptions simply because we're not used to it.
Yeah.
But the entire East and Southeast Asia eat soy every day. And all of this nonsense, stupid nonsense about it to reduce your testosterone. Boss, have you seen the population there? Do you think it has had any effect on their ability to produce testosterone?
I think it's mostly the meat-based community that is very anti-soya.
Yeah, yeah. Anti-soy and so on. Right? The soy boy and all that.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think, as I said, I think you can look at every meal and figure out whether it can be improved from a balanced standpoint. Mm-hmm. As a general rule, I think if I take a lower middle class South Indian or East Indian or a Northeast meal, it is starting from a better place. Let's just say that, right? And again, also remember that 70% of the calories in paneer are fat, not protein. Let's be clear. It has a lot of protein, but you can't just get the protein. So you're going to get a lot of fat also.
Yeah.
So, which kind of brings me to this other point that you mentioned, that the problem with also fats, right? With problem with nutritionists or the WHO and everyone else saying saturated fat, you must keep it down to 10% of your calories and so on, is that it is very hard to make any universal claim that this thing is bad for you, this thing is good for you.
Right.
Because there are genetic components to that. One of the side effects clearly of 20,000 years of being around cows and drinking or eating all the makhan you can and all the ghee you can, etc., clearly has given some people the ability to deal with saturated fats far better than other people. So you can slather one layer of makhan. And, you know, I remember I go to Chandigarh a while back, and these two, you know, large gentlemen, Sikh gentlemen came and ordered a paratha, aloo paratha in the morning. And then they said, Chotu, idhara, and then they gave him some money to go buy 100-gram packet of Amul butter from nearby, right? And the guy melted that entire 100-gram pack on
one paratha.
Aloo paratha. And yes, on two parathas. They kind of shared it. Two gentlemen shared it. So it was like 50 grams each. It was still, for me, it was like, man, I've grown up being told that you should not eat this much fat, clearly, right? And these guys clearly seem to have had no effect on them at all, right? So my point is that different people have different abilities to tolerate these things. So there are people in many parts of India, if they consume a little bit more ghee, their lipid profile goes for a toss. They'll suddenly, their doctor will say, hey, you have to cut down, etc., right? But in general, what I feel is that different people have different tolerances to different kinds of fats and also overarching amount of fat. So, for example, there are people, the carnivore diet people in general, do not seem to get heart trouble despite eating a very high fat meat, because most of red meat is a lot of fat, right? And saturated fat at it, right? And like people in Kerala, coconut oil is mostly saturated. You know what? Mm. Coconut oil is more saturated fat than ghee.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's 85% saturated fat. Your ghee and all is like some 50-60%.
Yeah. I also eat a mostly animal-based diet. I eat mutton kebabs in the day and I eat a keema at night. And in the middle, I will munch. Like if I'll have like one day a week, I'll have a roti or some chawal if I want. But I mostly eat meat. And I'm just fine. I feel perfectly fine.
As I said, so you people have got to test themselves.
Hmm.
People have got to feel good.
Yeah.
You have got to generally be able to see, you know, I think the best definition of, you know, healthy food and health in general is not a six pack. It's not visible muscles. It's not all of that. Being healthy is being able to have the freedom to do whatever you want to do.
Hmm.
If that means mountain climbing, it means doing certain things.
Sure.
If that means weightlifting, it means a certain things, right? If that means being able to work and focus and not get exhausted and have a regular career without getting into heart trouble and all of that, that also is being healthy. But that person may have a little bit of stomach flab, may not have visible muscles. They're fine. They're actually healthy, right? Again, as I said, tummy fat is usually not the problem. It's visceral fat that's the problem.
Yeah, there's several people in Okinawa and other blue zones who don't look like they're the peak of muscular health and they live to 90.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So it's not, so there's multiple ways to be healthy and it is all genetic. So there is no one single, so you need to figure out what works for you. Eat as many diverse things as possible and recognize that some things will work for you, some things may not work for you. And again, keep testing yourself to see what it is, right? And adjust appropriately, right? So people somehow want a very simple, this Satvik meal is the only thing that all Indians must eat. Are you kidding me?
Right? Yeah.
I mean, it's just completely silly, right? Most people cannot digest whole dals at all.
Yeah. I don't like dal at all. Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting that you say that. I think, unfortunately, there is a tendency in people who call themselves experts to prescriptionize. And then there is a tendency in people who are lost in nutritional matters to receive those prescriptions like they're the words of God. And that's where the trouble happens. Because like there are also other reasons. For example, if you live in a non-veg household and you suddenly decide to go vegan, there are problems with that. If you live in a purely vegetarian household and you decide to eat meat, you have to sort of hide away. There are other factors. If India had the sort of sexual and culinary freedoms that other countries enjoy, we would not have any of the gross politicization and polarization we have around food.
I think it's also a case of, Sethi, we are a society that has... in general, what happens is that culture change takes longer than technological disruption.
Sure.
So what happens is that, we've gone from, me and my family waiting 3 years to get a telephone line from BSNL when we moved to Delhi. To essentially having a fiber optic internet at a price point that the West can't even dream of.
Sure.
Right? 1 Gbps internet. Right? So technological disruption has been like super fast.
Hmm.
But culture takes time to change. Right. So all of a sudden you suddenly have microwave, you have dishwasher, you have fridge, you have... in one generation we have all of that.
Yeah.
It's not possible for people to suddenly accept all of these changes in one generation. And food is very hard to change. So essentially, I think, whereas the US has had 300 years of slow, continuous progress. People had microwaves in 1930s and 1940s. Okay? They had refrigerators in like the early part of like the 1920s. So change has been like, it is possible for every generation to see some small incremental change in the next one and slowly learn to accept that. But all of a sudden, think about like, my generation, we saw 100 things that my previous generation did not. So, of course, they're going to protest and say, hey, boss, are we moving too fast, right? I think that's going to be natural. And food habits are the hardest to change. So, that's why you kind of see this other pattern of misinformation, which is that everything from this generation is wrong. But previous generation was right. And the funny thing is that if you step back 50 years ago, everything my father's generation did was considered wrong by my grandfather's generation, including things like pressure cooker. Including things like, it's a gas stove. and LPG was introduced, my grandfather was like, no, wood fire. I don't get the flavor. It is not healthy. Right? It is gas. It is petroleum. It is dangerous. You know, they were saying, even in the Uncle G's creating WhatsApp forward level gyan, I've always existed. But the only WhatsApp exists now. That's the only thing.
Hmm. That's true. Right? That's true.
So basically, and people sounding off on this is completely natural, because the resistance to change and the conservative mindset is natural in all societies. And especially in societies that are changing so fast that 10 changes are happening within our generation. Right? It's like how, like even me, I had trouble figuring out what the hell TikTok and Instagram reels were, having gotten used to the social media generation of blogging and Orkut and those kinds of
Yahoo things. Messenger, that stuff.
Yahoo Messenger, ICQ, right? Yeah. So the problem is now generation shifts are happening intra-generation.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. Before we sort of start wrapping things up, I do want to ask you about, it's prevalent in Delhi. It's far more prevalent in Bombay and Bangalore. And I'm not sure what's the case in Chennai. But there, if you go to Google Maps and you search healthy food options near me, you typically go to a place which has all kinds of detox shakes and smoothies. Yeah. It has superfood bowls where you have spirulina and avocado, acai bowls, all of that.
Yes. Yeah.
I will say, after having eaten them, for 500 rupees, and it's very subjective. Okay, so you can say this is subjective, Vinamra, and you're completely saying the wrong thing. I don't feel satiated as much as I feel like I'm doing something for my health. And
no, you're right. I
just struggle to see why health food places that essentially work like a fine dining restaurant in terms of prices are able to market themselves very well. And like the key ingredient is, if it's got an avocado toast on it and it's 570 rupees, yes, people will buy it in hordes, knowing despite the fact that the bread might not even be sourdough bread. It might be the worst white bread possible, but they will still eat it because the avocado toast is the paragon of health.
Yeah. So nutritionally speaking, you can pick up so many vegetables from your grocer that are native. They're going to be as healthy and as nutritious as an avocado. Okay. Right. So the point is that I think these ideas are coming from people who traveled to the West and
who went to LA and figured it out. Yeah.
Yeah. And they come here and now they have the money to create these things. Right. Mm. And the honest truth is that, honestly speaking, it's very hard to be satiated on any meal other than what you grew up eating as comfort food in general. It takes a fair amount of effort to be able to experiment and be open to other flavors, other textures that are completely alien, other grains, other ingredients. It's very hard, right? So that's one thing. The second thing is that this entire thing is literally just the rich trying to tell you that they have money and they want to that one specific idea of what they think is healthy. Basically, there are people who think that Indian food can't be healthy, okay? And that it has to be all of this fancy stuff, that you need these microgreens and all of that, right? The fact of the matter is that any qualified nutritionist will tell you that you can take anything that you eat traditionally, as long as you get the balance, that's going to be the healthiest thing you can eat, because your gut bacteria and everything else are used to that.
Yeah.
Right? Introducing a ton of new things, right, not necessarily almost always a good thing for everyone. You may be a foodie, etc., etc. But again, even say I keep traveling, right? As part of my job. So I keep traveling. So I keep eating food from every part of the world. But I absolutely want to come back completely. My idea of detox is to eat home-cooked food. That's what detox is, right? And people think detox is eating some stupid Asgard juice and all of this other kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
The first thing is that, it's going to be controversial, but unfortunately, detox is bullshit. You cannot detox your body by eating something.
Oh, you've got balloons.
I have no idea. I think it's some automatic hand gesture based thing
Say that sentence one more time. Yeah.
Yeah. So you cannot detox your body by eating something. All you can, the only thing that detoxes your body is your liver and kidney.
So fasting is better?
Yes. And eating a regular, non-stressful, non-alcoholic, non-processed, regular meal will allow your kidney and liver to function as they were intended to. And they will function to the best capacity of their genetics. Some people do it better, some people won't. That's all. And there's little you can do about it. But your overarching lifestyle, the amount of food you eat, how regularly you eat, all the diversity of things you eat, how much stress you give your system is really all there is to it. So when people say you drink this juice, it will detox you, that's complete bullshit. If anything, it's going to stress your system. Remember that random raw plant products are a huge stress on the liver. We are animals. Plant kingdom entirely evolved to evolve defenses to prevent animals from eating them. But human beings, being smart, have managed to cultivate and domesticate a small number of species like rice, wheat, potato, this. So a few families of plants to be less toxic so that we are able to eat them. You go randomly take stuff like leaves and other things of parts of the plant that you're not supposed to eat. They are all bad for you on the long run. This is true of green tea. This is true of every goddamn detox juice. This is true of turmeric water. You are not meant to drink that. It's going to completely mess up your liver, right? So more than these things actually being healthy, these are all scams. There is no evidence that these things are actually good for you. There is no peer-reviewed evidence. So you can, so the moment you hear the word detox, you know the person is a scamster. Because your body detoxes itself. You just give it a break. You drink water, you eat normal, regular food in moderation. Or fast, yeah, if you can. That's it. If you're diabetic, you may not. But you just give it a break and you eat. Yeah, just don't eat like stressful stuff like burgers and deep fried stuff and chips and these things. You'll be fine. Right? You don't need a juice. The juice does nothing. The juice actually hurts. The juice damages. Because it's going to stress your liver. Because random raw plant products, undigested plant products, they have a ton of toxins that your liver now has to get rid of.
Man, you and the liver doc on a podcast would be insane.
No, I mean, so I'm good friends with Abby, right? And so yeah. We've in fact collaborated once on an Instagram post that upset a lot of people. Because we said Ayurvedic tasir of hot and cold actually makes no sense. And it really just made people very angry.
Yeah, I'm...
There are no such thing as a hot and a cold food and all that.
I'm supposed to interview him sometime in January.
Yes.
Yeah. No, but fascinating stuff.
Yeah, he pulls no punches, right?
I know.
But the point is that I think, you know, people need to realize that, you know, we are animals. Right? And as animals, there's a small number of things. The fact that we are able to eat some plants is remarkable human ingenuity. Okay. Otherwise, either you're a cow, which has had millions of years of evolution of being able to eat any part of a plant, and it has a goddamn industrial machinery in its stomach where it can over 4 days digest anything the plant kingdom throws at it. Okay?
Can't believe you said industrial machinery.
Exactly, right? I mean, if you sort of go read high school biology, I took biology in like...
Yeah. You know, no, the anatomy of a cow is pretty incredible.
Man, insane what it can digest, right? And one more thing, okay? A rhinoceros has to eat like 2 tons of grass to get the same nutrition that you get by eating a small packet of French fries.
That's crazy.
So, right? So, why are human beings controlling the planet? Because we don't have to goddamn keep eating 2 tons of grass every day.
Yeah.
Why? Because one, we invented cooking. Because we can take those plant products, make all the worst, horrible, anti-nutrient, poisonous stuff completely denature. Yeah. Which is why I find it so funny when people say raw food. It is a terrible idea. A side salad is excellent.
Even raw milk? Even raw milk?
Raw milk is completely dangerous, please. It's unpasteurized. It can have bacteria that can absolutely kill you.
Really? There's such a big community of like meat eaters on...
It is ridiculous. It is completely ridiculous. It is completely dangerous.
What are you saying?
Do not. Yeah, it is. It. You know something? There's an interesting statistic.
Prior to the
introduction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I've seen several videos of friends going directly to the cow's udder and drinking it as is. I've done it in my childhood as well. A couple of times.
Again, as I said, look. Theoretically speaking, if you take your car and drive,
yeah,
there is a non-zero chance that you could get in an accident.
I know what you mean. Right? Okay, okay.
Theoretically, if you smoke one cigarette, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Theoretically, if you have a beer once a week, you will be fine.
Yeah.
But then again, at the end of the day, these are, whether you have the appetite for that risk or not, and particularly the problem with things like raw milk is that it's fine. If it was an extraordinarily healthy cow, grew up in a very healthy environment, highly hygienic, etc., etc., absolutely. I think it's fine. That milk is less likely to have some botulinum toxin or salmonella or any of these very dangerous things, right? That's why raw egg and raw milk can harbor these pathogenic bacteria. And again, it's really about, do you want to take that risk? Because trust me, if you get botulism, it is brutal. You do not want to get that. Your entire life will go for a toss. Okay, salmonella too, right? And so therefore, I think it's really about whether or not you want to take that risk. And here's the point. It's all statistics at the end of the day, right? You, one by one, I may have also had raw milk at some point of time and we both of us may have survived.
Yeah.
But that, we are a billion people. Before pasteurization, okay, 100,000 people used to die from raw milk in just the US every year. And that entire deaths due to raw milk just completely vanished the moment we started pasteurizing. So, which is why the government said, you've got to pasteurize. Because you know what? We're saving. It's one thing, right? 100,000 people died. Imagine the number of people who would have gone to the hospital, been in agony, and done or gone through all of that stuff. It's a tremendous cost to society. It's a risk not worth taking. It's just the point, right? And that too, particularly, I think nobody can stop you from personally trying it, but to promote it as a is as a good practice is just patently dangerous.
Man,
because more, I don't know how. Because the point is that are you sure that the raw milk, wherever that, if you got it directly from the cow that you know in a farm you trust from a farmer and a cow that you know has been hygienically kept, etc., etc., are you certain that the cow from where you got that raw milk did not have a bacterial infection?
No.
In a country like India, right, knowing what conditions are like, it's just simply not worth it. Because we live in such crowded, polluted, unhygienic conditions now compared to 100 years ago when farms were small, artisanal, the air was less polluted, the cow was probably less sick all the time. Right?
Wow.
So as I said, I think you know the problem is that I think many of these kinds of ideas about health are not generalizable. I think people just need to realize. And also I think people sometimes forget the basic rule of statistics, that it is risk. So the difference between danger and risk. Danger is, classic example is, this preservative. If I give 50 grams of this preservative to a rat for 3 weeks, it will get cancer.
Okay.
Is the danger.
Mm.
And influencers will say, therefore, you know, you must not eat anything with preservatives. Okay. What is the actual risk? Are you a rat? You're not. Are you eating 50 grams of it force-fed to you over 20 days? No. You're eating a few micrograms as part of a biscuit, right? At best in a day. So therefore, the dosage got nowhere close to what that experiment was where they proved that.
Sure. Okay.
And the other thing is that suppose you add something that did not have that antimicrobial preservative, which then developed an invisible fungus and mold, which you did not catch, and you ate it, and that cost you food poisoning. So what is the greater risk here? Right? So I think people sometimes forget that they're not sort of really figuring out denominators here. Right? If there's one thing we need to fix, forget teaching science. Let's teach probability to people better.
Yeah. Or how to read scientific papers and not use them as your own propaganda conveniently.
Out of context, right? I mean, and there's a difference between, what is a single study on rats? What is an observational study where at best you can draw correlations? People who are unhealthy already and eat a lot of red meat are more likely to get cancer is an observational study. Which now people are saying people who eat red meat will get cancer. That's not the finding at all. Because like you can be healthy and eat all the butter you need. right? Because so that's a problem. So then there are observational studies. Then there are meta-analysis, which is a higher bar where you look at multiple studies. And meta-analysis of studies that have been over many years, over a large sample size. That's the gold standard. So people need to know that even people nowadays, the problem is the pseudo-scientific people are also using science to misinform.
I'm so glad people like you exist, because in this conversation alone, I feel twice as enlightened as I first got into it. Even though, I was watching your video on bread, and I was supposed to go out with Abhijit for lunch, but he had to go somewhere else to another friend's podcast. So we decided that he was just going to go. So because I was watching your video on bread, I suddenly had a nostalgia and love for bread once again. Yeah. And I ordered a burger. And usually before podcasts, I often think, yaar, if I eat this, I'm going to get brain fog and not be able to focus. But because I didn't have that in my head, I ate the burger and I researched just fine. And I think I'm mentally more or less as agile as I was. Yeah. And if I do it for a long period of time, I'm going to notice it more.
Exactly. And not only that, if you have for example, the thing is that people in the US, the poor people, sometimes work two jobs. They work 15 hours a day.
Yeah.
They don't get enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, their only diet is a McDonald's burger of some kind. And fries. Yeah. They don't get enough vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting enough of their gut microbiome. And then they're eating like munching on chips and other candy and other processed things, etc. And they do that over decades. Mm. Right? Of course, they're going to have bad outcomes. Right? But what do people think? Burger is to blame. Of course not. It's a ton of things. Societal conditions, structural poverty. Many things are to blame. Right? The problem is, we all like this Gabbar Singh. There has to be this one evil thing, right? Maida. Maida is the villain. If I just get rid of Maida, everything will be fine. And what do? You like say, in South India people, Kerala Parota, I want it made with atta. It's equally unhealthy, boss. Right? So you're better off saying, I will eat one parota instead of two.
Right.
That's a better choice than saying that I will switch to millet biscuits are healthier. No bullshit. Millet tastes like cardboard. You know, so what do people do? They add tons of butter, tons of oil, tons of salt and tons of sugar to make it palatable. Basically, your millet biscuits are far more unhealthy than your maida biscuits.
Wow.
Right? So I think it's all about people, again, want to do the cheap, simple signaling thing.
Hmm.
Right? That they feel good about. Because the harder thing to do is to eat less food.
Well, that is a universal phenomenon. And hopefully with this conversation, people will at least get a nuanced perspective on not just nutrition, but how you cannot simply take one rule that you see on a reel as a default eating standard and dictate your life on that. Right.
And I also want to say that I sometimes also find that people will say things like, I will blindly trust anything you say. Please don't do that. The goal of my reels is to arm you with some basic ways of scientific thinking that then you can independently apply to content that you see, right?
Hmm.
So because I'm a human being, I can make mistakes. And I can also, in a 90 second, there are things that I can say and cannot possibly say. And you cannot assume and you can misinterpret me in much the same way, even without my sort of this thing. So do not blindly trust anyone, including me, right? So I think be skeptical. Build a set of skills and don't overcomplicate your relationship with food. Eat a large bunch of things you are comfortable and you love eating and eat them in moderation and exercise a lot, right? And then keep checking what works for you. Sometimes you'll discover that you might actually be more allergic to milk than you think you are. Some people are allergic to eggs, some people are allergic to peanuts, right? You figure it out, right? Be more mindful, right? And that's really all there is to it.
Awesome. Thank you. It was an honor to speak with you. Where can people find you if they want to follow you, check out your work?
Okay, so basically Google for my name. I think Krish Ashok on Twitter, _masala_lab on Instagram, Krish Ashok on YouTube. So generally just Google for my name. I think you'll get all my different avatars and the same Krish Ashok on Spotify or iTunes Music and so on. Yeah.
Okay, amazing, amazing. Thank you for your time, bro. And I'll see you for another conversation, hopefully in person, if I'm in Chennai or if you're in Delhi.
Oh, yes, we should. Yes.
Okay, awesome. Okay, this was Krish Ashok on Dostcast. We'll see you all in the next episode. Don't forget to subscribe. Take care. Bye-bye. Sayonara.